How would you say, I'm not used to that work?
Hello, agus falchearash. In this, our third episode, I talk to Anne-Marie O'Brien, who is the director of our Irish Script on Screen project, which has so far digitized roughly 425 manuscripts. You will find out how these same manuscripts managed to knock out a server in Oxford. And for optimal enjoyment of this podcast, have the website www.isils.dais.ie at the ready. Enjoy! So welcome to the third episode of the School of Celtic Studies podcast, Nianza. And today I'm joined in digital fashion by Anne-Marie O'Brien, who is the director of the Irish Script on Screen project, which is run at Dais. Her other function title, as we know her, is the one-woman miracle behind ISOS.
Oh, thank you.
As Michal Hoyne mentioned in the last episode, she's the woman who makes it possible for Celticists to watch medieval manuscript in their pajamas at home. So we are very grateful to her for that. So hello, Anne-Marie, you're very welcome. How are you?
Hello, thank you for having me.
Of course, yeah. We're all fascinated by what you do, so I'm really thrilled to have a chance to ask you more about that. And as you know, the questions will be in Old Irish, but they will be translated as well. So I'll just start with our very first question, which is Cesht, Cead the Hof on them Shifain, agus Cith the Tukon Shin. What is your name? Which is a bit superfluous, but I ask it anyway. What is your name? And what brought you here digitizing manuscripts at Dais?
Okay, well, I'll give you a little bit of a history about myself. My name is Anne-Marie O'Brien, and I'm currently the director on the Irish Script on Screen project in the School of Celtic Studies. Irish Script on Screen, or ISOS as it's commonly named, is a mass digitization project of Irish manuscripts. But I first started out myself in communications and media studies, but I found I was drawn more towards the photography study side. So this led me on to following that with a degree in technology and commercial photography at Dunleary Institute of Art, Design and Technology.
Very cool.
So at the end of all of those studies, it was about 2002. And digitization at this point was out there, but it wasn't something that, as we know it today, there was one digital camera in my on my course.
Oh, wow.
And everyone looked at it as being very quite odd and something that we weren't really sort of interested in, because at that point when you took a picture, it took a couple of seconds, so if the person moved at all, it would be blurry, and so we just kind of looked at this going, oh god, that's never going to take off. So how
wrong
that,
yeah.
You know, so I mean, at that stage there was no internet access on phones, certainly no cameras on phones, so this digital sort of revolution had not begun in any sort of shape or form. So when in 2002, when I was finishing my degree, this vacancy came for a digital technician on a 1-year contract to work on the Irish Script on Screen project.
All right, yeah.
So I was interested to see what the project involved. And it was, as it was just for 1 year, I thought I'd give it a shot.
Oh, yeah.
So I was hired.
It was a very young project at that stage as well, because I was doing some Googling and I found an article in the Irish Times from 1999 stating that Irish manuscripts were to go online. Was that the very beginning of ISOS as a project?
Yeah, it was. It was something that was a need, I think, for the School of Celtic Studies, because they were publishing a lot of research material at the time. Mm-hmm. I think they wanted to have, you know, quality imagery to go with them in their published books. So I think this was sort of like a brainchild of trying to sort of collaborate that together. So I think they were, you know, very tense of looking around to see what other people were doing. And I think they were trying to follow. There was also an early manuscripts project going on in Oxford that had begun in 1995. So they were trying to sort of look at that model and see how they would, you know, start their own.
So because my other question was ISIL's actually the first digitizing project of medieval manuscript, but Oxford beat them to it.
They did. We were, I'd say, probably one of the first in Europe.
It was still pretty cool.
I mean, the people who were starting the project in Oxford were coming across and helping at the time of Celtic studies. So there was a lot of back and forth between the two projects to see what was working. So when I kind of came onto the project, there was Porco McCann as director and another senior technician at that point, Colin Dunn, who had gone over to the Oxford project to see what they were doing. And then at that stage as well, because IT was such a large, you needed such a large storage facility for these images, like they were just huge. We wouldn't have been able to store memory as we do now. We were in partnership with DCU under the supervision of Professor Alan Smeaton at the time, so that they could provide the necessary technical expertise in digitization processing and storage, because I mean we were still floppy disking at this point. Because you know, so one image was kind of being stored at a time. It was so painful.
I even wonder, like, people who listen to this podcast, would they still remember floppy disks?
Oh,
it feels like ages ago. I still remember them, by the way, so that shows my age, but that's madness. So how, if you took a picture, would that actually fit on a floppy disk, or would you need like multiple floppy disks for one image, or how would that work?
Well, we had cartridges at that point. They were really chunky, and I think they sort of stored about 5 gigabytes of data. So you would get a couple of images on there at the time. Was it 500 megabytes? I'm not too sure. But so you would have, then you'd have your tape machines as well, that you'd have to run them off certain computers. So it was a bit of a nightmare, because when you were sending stuff across to the libraries as well, each of them had their different tape drives that you would have to accommodate. So it was just, but I was going to go through the difference in IT as well that we had over the years, because that's quite interesting in itself. Because when we set up, we had 2 servers for 2 terabytes of data, and they cost a significant amount of money, like 20,000 euros per 2 terabytes. And they were huge, the size of fridges. And whereas now I can get a 2 terabyte portable drive that I can carry around in my bag, like it's tiny, you know, and it costs 80 euros. So, I mean, technology has just changed so much in the 20 years that I've been working on this project. And I think that's what one of the biggest things is for digitization projects now. It's like, the not only are you taking images, you have to be very careful about how you're going to conserve your digital data as you go on.
That's definitely an issue we will discuss further, because I'm very interested in the digitization, or preserving digitization, as it were, because it's a very difficult thing now in academia. But for yourself, how do you keep up with all these developments? Because you graduated in 2002, I think you said. And then, then all the stuff you learned was probably very different from what you need now. Or is it? Or how do you keep up?
Yeah, so well, I'll go back to 2002. And so when I came on, there was 3 of us on the project, and then DCU were taking on all of our digital material. So because we were starting to increase our workload, because now we had 2 technicians digitizing constantly, their workload became too much because we were relying on the help of students to sort of go through this.
Right. Oh, cool. So you did a sort of a crowdsourcing.
Yeah. So we'd send over the data in big batches and then they would send it back and they were sort of controlling, I think at that point as well, our website and some ways of putting the stuff up for us. Because I think on the Oxford project, they were realizing that storing this material was a huge feat. I think at one point all the servers were knocked down by them putting up all of this material. Yeah, so it was, you know, a thin line of how you were going to actually put
stuff
up.
Medieval manuscripts knocked out a server. That's pretty cool.
It was,
like, not for them at the time, obviously, but it's a pretty cool feat for a bunch of medieval manuscripts to knock out the most advanced technology of the time.
You have to remember, this was just revolutionizing the way in which we were doing things. I think nowadays we just take it that, you know, this always was there, but it wasn't, you know. People are so used to having access to everything that they want at their fingertips, but you certainly weren't able to do that 20 years ago. Still going into libraries and figuring out how you were gonna, you know, get your hands on things. But unfortunately, they left in 2004 because the workload just became too much for them. And I were in around that time as well, Colm left the project, he went out on his own. So we were kind of at a standstill of how we were going to fulfill the role now of this new sort of technical role that we needed.
Yeah.
So I went back to college then at nighttime to do another degree.
Fair play.
In IT, because I was like, I mean, I came in to the project knowing photographic principles and techniques, but my IT skills, I mean, you know, thank goodness we have Andy on our, and he stuck with us because I was afraid things. I was like, I just had such a fear of computers.
Yeah, and so, shout out here to Andrew McCarthy, who's also putting up our podcast online and taking care of that aspect of the podcast. So thank you very much, Andy.
Absolutely.
Yeah, you're a star.
A lot of this just wouldn't be possible without the help. You know, dedication of people who've really put in their time over the years. So I went back to study and figured out that computers weren't so scary. And
very good.
I wasn't going to delete things forever, you know. And I kind of took over that role as well. So just to kind of keep the project going, because, again, I was kind of only brought on for 1 year and it was very much known, you know, you're only going to be here for a year. This is what you're going to do, you know, and afterwards you're going to be gone. And I was like going, okay. And then every year it was like, can you stay for another year? I was like, okay, I'll give it another year, you know. And then you sort of, I think manuscripts, they just, on Irish history, they just take something, you know, you just fall in love with it. You know, you just can't leave it go. Once you're sort of involved and invested, you just fall in love with it, I think. And you just feel very, like, be proud, and this is your history, and you need to be able to keep on going. And
they're amazing objects, medieval manuscripts, and they just they make you fall in love with them. Yeah, because that's, I wanted to ask you that as well, like, did you know about medieval manuscripts before you started at Dias? Did you have an interest in them at all? Or
clue. And I think even for the first few years that I was there, it was very much, and I think that's what's difficult about some of the digitization projects when you go out, because you're looking for people who have skills now in photography, heritage photography, they don't necessarily have librarian skills or archive skills.
Right.
So they don't have sort of a knowledge of what the subject matter is about, you know, and how fragile it is. And so you need to be very careful, because when I started off first as well, I thought it was very much a photography project. And that's the way I went at it. But I learned over my time that, you know, it's not that, it's that and more. You have to be able to be really respectful of the material, because these are primary sources. And once, you know, if they're damaged in any particular way, there's no going back, you know. It's not like you can find another copy. So,
although we're always hoping for that, but it very rarely happens.
I think it's, then we had Porco McCon left the project in 2012. So it's kind of landed then, and myself then as being the solo person on the project since then.
That's amazing as well for such a project, because there's a lot of different skills involved in it as well. I mean, there's the photo taking, but there's also the digital aspect and making contacts with libraries, I suppose, and people who have manuscripts. And that all boils down to you now, is it?
Yes. Of course, we definitely have, with the great academia staff that we have in School of Contents as well, I wouldn't be able to do it without people's help and the want that they have to help you out and the interest that people have. You know, I've come across so many people throughout 19 years that I'm there.
Yeah,
now.
You're almost up for a party at Dias.
I know.
Take note, people who listen.
It's and you have people who cross your paths over the years that I have done, and their love of manuscripts can be seen, and they want to help you out because they know what you're trying to achieve.
Yeah,
and you know, they'll go after it for you. You know, in their own particular way.
That's great.
The manuscript, they will sort of chase that for you because they know at the end of the day, you know, what you're trying to do is highlight this magnificent history that we have. You know,
I think everybody sees the importance of ISILS as a project, and therefore is willing to put an extra effort in to make it happen.
I think for me, I've always found people to be very flexible. If you're flexible with them, I mean, I always come at it as saying that, you know, I'm not a commercial body. We aren't. We're here for the students, for anyone who wants to have access.
Yeah.
We want to make our history open for everyone to enjoy, because it is sort of, as you said, like when I was in college, I never even heard of medieval, you know, other than seeing it in, you know, your school books. But to sort of understand that our history is so much part of us, it's definitely a proud moment that I can be involved in something like this.
Yes, I can imagine. And it's such a wonderful resource to have open access, because anyone can log on to ISOS, the website. We'll put the link up with the podcast as well, obviously, but the link is www.isos.dias.ie.
So
and anyone can go there and look at all these beautiful manuscripts, and the collection is just growing and growing and growing.
I mean, at the moment we have about 425 manuscripts online. So roughly, on my last count, there was about 80,000 large resolution images.
That's amazing, isn't it?
It's a resource that is used quite a lot. We've had about 5 million hits last year, so that's a lot of people coming and going. And you know, particularly with the pandemic, I mean, we need these sort of resources online so that we're still able to continue our work no matter where we end up. Because I think the workspace now has changed.
Definitely,
you know, we can't be tied to a particular place.
Yeah.
And we need to sort of be able to have fluidity, you know, with being able to carry on our work wherever we are. You know, through phones or tablets or whatever is
In our pajamas or not in our pajamas, all that. Yeah. And I made a list as well, but it fell down, so I'll just have to grab it here. With all the, because they're Irish manuscripts that you put up online, but they're not all from Irish libraries. So the manuscripts that you have are actually from as wide a range as Australia, Britain, Belgium, Ireland, Scotland, and then some manuscripts that are in private collections. So that's a really amazing range of countries that are willing to cooperate on this.
Yeah, we have 25 different partnerships. And you said, most of the Irish manuscripts are held in large repositories in major libraries. And then you'll have a few that are in private collections as well. And then, you know, because of our history, you will have a lot of the manuscripts have been taken out of Ireland when, you know, different points of history when persecutions were happening, and they took them with them, you know, to safeguard them. So you'll have them turning up in the likes of the British Library, or one of our last projects was with the KBOR, Royal Libraries of Belgium. So, and even in that case, that's quite an interesting one. They were brought over to Leuven, to St. Anthony's College. And then they were sort of during the French Revolution, they were dispersed onto the KBR library in Belgium, and some were brought over to UCD. But so that collection in particular has been split. But because now with what you can do online, you can bring them back together. We have that collection now completed. So if you're doing your studies, you don't have to say, oh, you know, I'm going to have to go over, you know, to Belgium and then have to go down to UC. You know, you can continue on your studies and get the collection the way it was supposed to be. And I think that's really important to start bringing back our history together so that, you know, the study can be done as it was supposed to be. Another interesting one that's been split was our recent acquisition of the one in the British Library, which is Egerton MS 88, which is a Breton manuscript that came last year, I think it was, for the Galway's 2020 European Capital of Culture.
So
before that one came over, we didn't digitize it ourselves. It was digitized for insurance purposes. I think the O'Dovran family very kindly donated the money to get that one digitized. And but in that case, that manuscript itself has been split into two parts and then a fragment. So the other part was in the Royal Irish Academy, 23Q6. And then there's like this random fragment that ended up in Copenhagen.
Oh, wow.
So you'll have manuscripts that are just all, you know, been parted. And I think that fragment was sent by Charles Valency at one point because he was searching for Irish manuscripts, and he sent it over as so that people would be able to recognize the Gaelic script.
Oh, right.
But then it suddenly stayed there. So we have, you know, our history is
We all have books in our bookcase that was lent to us by a friend at some stage.
You know.
But they kept a manuscript fragment,
So, I mean, but in saying that, so it's very difficult to kind of be able to approach these libraries because initially you're thinking, gosh, you know, are they trying to, you know, are we coming across as trying to claim our Irish history back? And that's not what we're here to do. We just want to be able to get as much of the Irish manuscripts as we can to bring them together as a national repository and so that everyone can enjoy them the way that they were supposed to be.
It's an amazing thing for paleographers and philologists and codicologists that the digitization of these manuscripts allows you to have all these different fragments and actually digitally put them together again, so you can read the manuscript as the one book, as well as, I think, for a lot of the Brussels manuscript that you digitize, some of them are actually very fragile, and if you would go to the library and ask to see the manuscript, you wouldn't always be able to, because they're obviously very protective of these manuscripts, and they are in a fragile state, or they need to be repaired or whatever. So having them online and accessible to everyone is just such an incredible bonus for us as researchers. So that's
absolutely. It's it brings a lot of different aspects now for research. I mean, you can now compare two copies, just say, of the Ogham book, for instance, in Trinity Library with another copy in the Royal Irish Academy. And, you know, when you look at these side by side, you wouldn't have been able to do that before. Say, oh, you know, but I'm just going to rob it, bring it down the road, you know, give us a second.
Hang on a minute.
So it's just thrown up so much, because when you have a look at then the two side by side, you know, you're suddenly seeing things that you wouldn't have before. So it's great to be able to have that sort of tool. And as you say, just this is just revolutionizing the way in which we do our study. But I can bring you through a couple of my favorites that I have of my because, well, I'll start with the Royal Irish Academy, because we've been in partnership with them since the very beginning.
Right.
And they're still very much in our digitization schedule. So we have about 100 of their manuscripts up.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
They have
Do you know
2,000.
The percentage? Yeah, you were just about to say that. What is the percentage that you've put up online of their manuscript?
So, I mean, we are still there is about 5,000 manuscripts, Irish manuscripts around the world. Yeah. So, and we've done 425 of them. So we're still slowly going through.
A lot of work still to do.
Absolutely. Yeah. But I'll begin with the Stone Missal. Although it's mainly a Latin manuscript, it was one of our first to be digitized back in 2001. That's nearly 20 years ago. And it's a highly decorated manuscript, which is well over 1,000 years old.
And if you are listening at the moment, you can actually, while you are listening, you can go to ISIS and click on the manuscript and actually see what Anne-Marie is talking about. That might be nice.
Absolutely, yeah. Because generally I'd have very pretty slides to go.
Yes, yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. So go to the website and have the visual support for Anne-Marie's discussion of her favourites.
So this was a manuscript that was written at sometime between 792 and 803 AD. It was a vellum manuscript, which was meant, it means it was made from a prepared animal skin, typically calf skin, which was bleached and stretched and scraped until it was smooth. And this was a very precious commodity, but it was very durable, thank goodness. So
yes, yeah. It's much more durable than the books we have nowadays. So,
absolutely. I mean, some of the paper manuscripts that I have seen, unfortunately, they look like they, you know, are not going to take too much longer before the history sort of comes in and destroys what's left. But the vellum manuscripts, on the other hand, seem to be, you know, withstanding the time, you know, definitely. But this Stone Missal contains 67 leaves, and the first 11 of which comprise excerpts from the Gospel of St. John, believed to be written at the monastery of Lorher in Tipperary. The remaining 56 leaves comprise the Missal proper and contain the ordinary and canon of Mass, the order of baptism, of visitation of the sick and of the last rites. And the Stone Missal itself is small, a mere 15 centimetres high and 11 wide, small enough to be carried around by a priest on his travels. So
just bring it around with them.
Absolutely. Yeah. But what is particularly unique about this manuscript is that in the 11th century, there was a shrine made for it known in Irish as a cuadach. The shrine now resides in the National Museum of Ireland. And this is a shallow rectangular box made of oak and covered with decorated metal plates. But both the Stone Missal and its shrine were locked away for several hundred years in the walls of Lochinne Castle. And in 1735, the owner of the castle, John O'Kennedy, undertook refurbished works. And the manuscript shrine was discovered within the walls.
Oh, so it's such a fairy tale, isn't it?
Isn't it?
Yeah.
I love this. So during the very early stages of the ISIS project, both the Stone Missal and its shrine were briefly reunited together for the first time.
Oh, wow.
And I think that's one of the great aspects of ISIS and digitization, where you can kind of reunite our, you know, our Irish heritage together, no matter where it's found itself in modern times.
That's amazing.
It's such a, you know, to be able to place it in the box, and it's something that, you know, you'll never be able to do again. You know, because they're in such fragile states now.
And also, I think to note that this was such a practical manuscript that was actually used and probably treasured by someone such a long time ago, and then to hold it in your hands, that must be an amazing feeling.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, the amount of stuff that I have gone through.
Yeah, we're all very jealous of you, Anne-Marie.
Some of them are huge, and you just wonder how they manage to, you know, and every bit of vellum is used, scraps and scraps kind of put together. It's just so fascinating to see how these books are put together and, you know, were treasured. So I have my next one up on the spotlight is Lara and Ahida, or the book
Good Cow. One.
So this is also at the Royal Irish Academy, and it's a later early 12th century manuscript. And this one is written entirely in Irish. And we think it was compiled in the monastery of Clonmacnoise, and derives its name from the legends that it was partly written on vellum made from the hide of a dun cow who was a pet of St. Kiernan's at Clonmacnoise.
That's cool to have a cow for a pet.
And then you go.
It's definitely on my wish list.
Looking at it going, I'm going to use you later.
That's the not so nice part about it.
So it's commonly known to scholars as LU, and it's the oldest surviving manuscript literature written in Irish. LU contains the earliest versions of some of the most famous of Irish sagas, including the eulogy of Colm Cilla, believed to be the oldest taxon, Iris.
Ah, yes, we discussed that with Christina as well in our first podcast.
Yes.
Because Jacopo Bisogni just made a new edition of that text. Yeah.
Yeah. So I then go on to the Book of Ballymote.
Oh, yes.
That one was named after Ballymote in County Sligo, which is partly written in the castle belonging to Tomach MacDonagh. Me with my naming now.
So here we're moving from sort of monastery settings to the castle settings and the...
Yeah, it just trying to give you sort of an idea of the manuscripts now are stretching from the early part of the centuries right up.
Yes. So
this one, on its opening pages, there contains the Lara Gael or Erin or the Book of the Talking of Ireland. So it's a legend of the Irish people. And the narrative traces the history of the Irish back to Noah and tells the story of the arrival of various settlers to the island. And the story formed a standard element of the history of Ireland as recorded by medieval scholars. So you'll find a lot of those Lara Gael or Erin in a few of the manuscripts. I've seen quite a lot of copies of it. So it's quite an interesting one to see. And then one that I found quite fascinating is held in the National Library of Scotland.
We're heading off to Scotland now.
Yes, now internationally. And this manuscript holds signs of the zodiac, which I thought was very interesting.
Yeah.
So there would be sort of illuminations done of the different signs and then different descriptions. And I thought, jeepers, this is quite a modern take,
going back.
It was written in the 16th or 17th century by, and it's a medical manuscript written by various members of the Beaton medical family of Mull, an island off the west coast of Scotland.
All right.
And it will briefly describes the 12 constellations and the legends associated with their names. So you'll have chapter on the crab or the line or... And it's, you know, it's fascinating to see that it still relates to modern times. And we've still discussed the zodiac to this day.
Yeah.
You know, and I think people would be sort of intrigued to see it, you know, being discussed back then, because some of the explanations are very similar to what we have today. So,
yeah. And what was the name of that manuscript? I think I might have missed it.
7212.
All right. Okay. So if people want to look up the zodiac signs, they can... go to the National Library of Scotland and then that number. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah. And then another one that was quite interesting that I have done is the Farmley Elizabeth Primer manuscript. And it's from the Benjamin Ivy Library at Farmley, which was a lovely place to go and digitize.
Oh, I bet.
So picturesque. I mean, I used to come in the morning and go, yeah, this is where I want to be. It's just, it's lovely out there. So I definitely recommend anyone to have a trip out to Farmley because it's free and absolutely lovely for a stroll in Phoenix Park.